What does it feel like to inhabit an identity that the world, our communities, view as other? What does it feel like to inhabit an identity that the world, our communities, view as other?
So I often feel my otherness when I'm sitting in meetings at work. And I'll look around the room, around the table, and I find that I am the only. Being the only comes with a special kind of responsibility, a weight, that is not always easy to bear. I feel this special kind of responsibility, my onlyness, when conversations turn to diversity. I often have an internal dialogue running in my head. Should I speak up? Will I be silent? What will they say today? How am I holding my body? I don't want to convey frustration or anger. Do they hear themselves? Why do they have so many small visions and understandings of diversity? I know they're looking at me. Do they expect me to say something? Why does it have to be me all the time? I feel my otherness here, in this space as well. Most often I wrestle with my otherness, my family's otherness, when it comes to my boys. Is this the right place? Is this the right community for my boys? Will they learn to have a full sense of pride about who they are and why they are here? Would it be better for our family to attend a traditional African American church? Am I cheating them out of having a Black religious experience? And yeah, I feel guilty. I feel guilty that I'm not giving them a space to feel a sense of belongingness, a space where they can look out around the room and see beautiful faces that look like their own. And that was my childhood. There were few spaces where my presence, my identity, was not the other. I felt lonely and small. That one word the cute little redhead boy yelled at me cut through me. His utterance sliced into me, cut me into bits, and for a moment, I disappeared. And I didn't belong, and I didn't exist. Now, all grown up, I don't experience those soul-killing moments, and yet I feel my otherness. Not all the time, but frequently enough that those lonely moments, sometimes hurtful moments, stay with me long after a meeting, an encounter, a conversation. So, I'm tired, and yet I am unbroken, and I am wounded, and yet I am resilient.
I grew up in a household that was steeped in the fight for civil rights. My dad marched on Washington in 1963, and my parents joined the movement to integrate Boston's public schools. Bravely putting my sister on a bus in 1973, knowing it could be targeted. My sister, for her part, still recalls the glass Coke bottle that hit the window near her seat on the school bus. Thrown by whites who opposed busing Black kids to white schools and white kids to Black schools. We lived in a predominantly Black and Puerto Rican neighborhood. And if I'm honest, I'll admit that my white family and other white families that moved to the south end of Boston in the 60s and 70s began the gentrification process that turned the vibrant multicultural neighborhood of my youth into an increasingly white and fashionable neighborhood. Sometimes I long for the South End that nurtured my childhood. I see myself running through alleys with my sister, the adults on the street telling us to watch out for broken glass. I see myself walking to school with the kids on my block, how our group grew with each of the 5 blocks we passed, so that when we finally got to school, we were 25 strong. I love that I sat in classrooms where my teachers were as diverse in background as the kids that filled the seats. I offer that preamble to point out that despite the diversity of my surroundings, I still experienced privilege as a white middle-class child. No one questioned the appropriateness of my presence when I visited friends in Boston's predominantly white suburbs. I went to church camps and nature camps because my parents could afford to send me there. There's something quietly inebriating about privilege. You move through the world taking your access and your safety for granted, going where you want, when you want. Sometimes you are lured into forgetting that others can't move as freely. The taken-for-grantedness of safety disappeared when I first fell in love with a woman. I was 25. A couple months after we started dating, my girlfriend and I were leaving a Chinese restaurant in Cambridge, Mass. Holding hands, we started towards the crosswalk. As we approached it, a car sped by and a young man, his face full of contempt, stuck his face out the window yelling, "Dykes!" Spit flying. I froze, thinking for a terrifying second he might get out of his car. It was one of the few times in my life where who I was left me open to violence, bigotry, and hatred. It's so easy to become guarded when other people disapprove of you. You start treading a line. On one side is your deep knowing that you are God's child, perfect as you are. On the other side, you're an outcast, a misfit. You live on a certain margin where you may or may not fit in.
And so we continue. People who occupy an oppressed identity learn to see through 2 lenses. One lens is grounded in their sense of self and self-worth, and the other lens is informed by the discriminatory views of a dominant power. W.E.B. Du Bois called this double consciousness, or second sight. How have you experienced second sight?
So it is amazing that more than 100 years later, W.E.B. Du Bois' words continue to resonate so much truth. He wrote, "The Negro is a sort of seventh son, born with a veil and gifted with second sight in this American world," end quote. I often feel this gift of seeing the world, seeing myself through the eyes of others. I think this second sight makes me want to challenge what I think they see. Sometimes, second sight makes for funny moments, and I laugh in my head. When I wear my cowboy boots and I see faces and eyes, and they're confused. They didn't know that black women with locks could wear cowboy boots. These are moments when I consciously or unconsciously am trying to complicate blackness for others So I imagine that my presentation of blackness provides opportunities to break down barriers and assumptions. When I dressed up as a princess and visited my son's school, I was not surprised when the little girl with cute blonde ponytails told me that I absolutely could not be a princess. I did not look like a princess. The opportunities abound. So I have learned that while my black skin can place me in uncomfortable and funny situations, my racial identity is an opportunity to make the world a better place. I have the gift of second sight. But I am also clear, the gift of second sight is not a superpower. I am America, and I have learned her lessons well. Not too long ago, after a long day, I stopped at a CVS in Ashburn to pick up a bit of this and a little bit of that. But the moment I walked into the store, I noticed three young people, black, black, and black. They seemed to wander the store and hover a bit as if uncertain. I continued to shop. While standing at the counter and purchasing my items, one young man stood by, too close. I saw his youth. I saw his black skin. I saw his sagging pants. I made assumptions, because I am America, and America has taught me well. After I completed my transaction, he stepped up to me and asked if he could borrow my phone. In the split seconds it took my mouth to move, there was a cacophony of inner voices in my head. He is black. So what? Is he going to steal my phone? He is black. Kevin's going to be mad at me if my phone is stolen. He is black. And then the power of the gift of second sight compelled me, and I saw him. I saw his blackness. Sure, I responded. And I placed my cute green iPhone 5 into his young, dark, black hands. He quickly dialed a number and then spoke. Mom, I'm sorry, I didn't call earlier. Yeah, my car broke down. Yeah, I'm okay. My phone is dead. Can you come get us? Thanks, Mom. Love you. Then he looked up at me, handed me the phone, and said, thanks. And by the way, I really like your locks. I'm so thankful for that young man, for that moment. He saw me, and I was able to see him. So the daily weight of my racial identity is no small matter. I get tired of thinking about what others are seeing, how my dress, how my actions, my words reflect on their ideas of blackness. Is my behavior adding to stereotypes or breaking them down? I get tired of worrying about how the world is seeing my sons. Worrying and thinking about them in this world is spiritually and emotionally draining. But the truth is my identity builds fortitude. I am made stronger, more human, more loving by the gift of second sight.
I do look through two lenses as a non-heterosexual woman in Loudoun County. Sometimes it's so unsettling. There are the looks Clarissa and I get when we go about our lives, the awkward questions people ask, when really our relationship is none of their business. Like the man who sold us an exercise bike in Chantilly, who had no qualms saying, I know maybe I shouldn't ask, but I'm curious. How are you all connected? Are you sisters? Are you... I want to scream at him to shut up. I choose to breathe. Clarissa and I check in with our eyes. We tell him the truth and endure his stare. The sadness and anger of those moments also hone my sensitivity. They sharpen my perspective and show me secret and God-filled pathways. In a manner similar to Du Bois, Iranian-American poet Sholeh Wolpeh captures the unlikely power of the individual who lives as the other. Quote, being a foreigner everywhere, not belonging anywhere, can be disquieting. But once you're over that, it's liberating. Suddenly you find yourself part of something greater, something indefinable and exhilaratingly new. You're granted access to places, the existence of which is not on most people's radars. Places that clear a path to a strange kind of knowledge, something that is learned instinctively and without instruction. Once there, empathy comes easily. You melt into other people's skins, look through their eyes at the world, without judgment or even agreement. Your only desire being to understand.
We conclude with, who are you?
I am black.
I am white.
I am straight.
I am gay.
I am a woman.
I am a woman.
We are undefinable. Yeah.